This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 327 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So before we get into this episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Laura D. And if you don't know what that means, or you want to find out more, like, what the heck is this co-producer, and how can I get my name on an episode of the Outlander podcast as a co-producer, you can find out more at patreon.com/outlanderpod. And a co-producer specifically is a, we hope they're fans, because if you're supporting something you're not a fan of, that would be a little, you know,
awkward.
Maybe awkward. I mean, we're still happy that you support us, but I'm going to assume a fan. It's a fan or someone who wants to support our show in a very special way. They support us monthly. And a co-producer is our, we have three levels, $1, $5, $1. $1, $5, $1. $10. Those who support us at the $10 level each month are our co-producers, and the names will rotate. So the more names we have, then the more co-producers we'll have. But everyone eventually, I put a date by every name, so no one is left out until, well, no one is left out, period. But I know that I don't repeat people until we have gone through everyone on that list, and then we'll start again. So that's for that. And also, I thought, Summer, we should mention real quick, because it's getting closer, a little bit closer. I wanted to quickly mention our Pod Abroad 2021 trip. So we have been able to go on to organize some amazing trips to Scotland that are bespoke Outlander themed tours. We visit historical sites and as well as filming locations, and have an amazing leaving dinner, which is our last evening to get dinner together. And it's magic. At least for us, it's been magical. And we're returning to our leaving dinner on a yacht in 2021. And we would love for you to join us. There are still a few spots left. And we would love to be able to welcome you as one of our attendees. So you guys, check out podabroad.com. which should take you straight to the page. And if there's any issue, I will also include a direct link to the Spirit Journeys website, which has our tour on it. So,
and now on to our episode recap.
So, unless I'm mistaken, because we've only had two, so I hope I'm not mistaken, this episode 502, that was our first cold open of the season.
Last week was a cold open.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, because they had the Myrta Jamie scene that went into the scene.
Oh, okay. So I was wrong. Tell me more of that, Summer. What was it?
Nope. I'm not going to sing you a song. I'm not singing you a song.
So I was wrong. It's our second cold open of the season. So this is interesting. Something I'll talk more about later in this, in my notes. So far, that's 2 for 2 cold opens. I wonder, it doesn't mean anything, but I wonder if that's kind of a direction they're going in. Number two, I noticed, I mean, it makes sense because now they're all together. They're no longer like trying to find somebody. They're no longer, you know, being kidnapped and taken around and blah, blah, blah. But have you noticed that last episode, 501, and this episode, they are absolutely, finally, centering Roger's character as a singer?
I mean, he did it multiple times.
That's what I mean. At least one time in the first episode, right?
Love.
Love. Okay. One time, I think. And in this episode, it was twice. He did Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog, and he sang at that funeral. Exactly. So it's not just showing him as, and I don't even know that we saw him singing at the funeral. We just heard him. Am I right? Am I wrong?
They mostly showed the casket.
Casket.
Going into the
ground. So that to me is almost more powerful, because they're showing us, they're centering him as a singer. They're establishing his role, or at least something that he's known for, as his character is known for this season. 100%, right? That is a change. Not because he suddenly learned how to sing, but because last season it wasn't a chance for it.
I feel like they've not only solidified him as a singer for the as a character,
yes,
characterization, but they have also solidified him as the guy you go to hide a body.
Oh, well, that's kind
of the friend you call to hide a body.
Perhaps, yeah, we'll get to that. But the reason I think it's more powerful to have him singing but not on camera is because to me that shows that his role, at least one of them, as a singer is being more woven into their Ridge society, that they don't even need to show, because he's not performing, right? He's the main event, if you will, is the burial, right? It's the funeral of this dude. Or not the dude. It's a funeral for this casket. And it's not his role. He's not center stage. He's there to add ambiance, ceremony, not a worship song, but, you know, a formal kind of, maybe not ritual, but he's there to add to the religious overtones of this very deeply religious believing society. And so... So that I thought was actually more powerful than having him sing, even though I loved it more. I loved him singing Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog or Joy to the World. But it was, to me, it's more powerful not to have him on stage, not to have him on camera singing, because it shows us he's kind of become in the background. He's important, but he's not centered there, right? So that to me tells us how, at least so far, how he is becoming part of his being a singer is becoming part of the norm in their society. And that is much stronger than just having him, you know, perform somewhere. So after a brief recap of 501, we're taken straight into Tar and Feather. I will say that it was done quite effectively. I do not believe torture is ever an answer nor justified. And I may surprise some people, and I this is a very strong word to use, and I know I do not hate this character, okay? But seeing what they did, and that's completely historically correct, maybe not the regulators, but it was 100% done. It was done. I mean, I remember hearing about that in elementary school, tarring and feathering. I had no clue what it was, but really? That's 100%.
Even now?
When I was like eight, now I do. Okay. When I'm talking about, I was like eight. Come off it, girl. But when I saw this, and then the camera goes to Murtaugh, and he's like, yeah, do it, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I got to say, it made me hate Murtaugh just a little bit. And it made me sad that I had that feeling.
Well, you know, this whole episode to me felt a lot like it was driving home the idea that they were literally all the same. They had more in common than they didn't. And the only thing that they didn't have in common was which side of the government they were on. And if most of those people took the government completely out of play, any number of them could have coexisted quite happily. And it just happened the way that things fell, that they ended up on these sides where but both sides were doing horrific things. Both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Like, I would have been hard-pressed to pick a side in this particular instance, because what they both did, what both sides were doing, was awful.
Yes, and it's a good point, because I can only speak for myself, but I would hazard a guess that many Americans, or at least people who, if not born here, who were raised in our society and schooled in American public schools, at least, because that's my experience, you know, and this people are going to probably argue with me, but this is just the truth. A part of the role of schools is education, absolutely, but it's also socialization. Now, I don't mean socialism. I mean socialization as in children learning to get along, children learning social skills. I mean, even if they don't, you know, teach you how to, you know, sit at a table and fold your hands or whatever, right? Manners. They're not explicitly taught. Necessarily. They may be some places. I don't know. They are things like how do you behave in public, right? Where, yeah, I'm sure parents do their best, but when kids get around other kids, especially like say in kindergarten or preschool or whatever, like they're still, a lot of kids at least can be wild and rambunctious because they're kids. That's what kids, not every child, but many kids, especially little boys, and maybe little girls too, are just like, you know, they're that's how they learn, is they run around, they get into things, they are experiencing their environment. So part of the role of schooling, besides education, like of facts and history and hopefully critical thinking, is learning how to cope with, be in an environment with other people where you can coexist outside of your family, because it's sometimes, not all the time, potentially, I wouldn't say easier, but it's one thing to be at home, right? And then maybe you don't behave well at home or whatever, but it's being able to learn behavior skills, a lot of things. Okay, that was a lot more than I meant to say. So a lot of people, people who grew up in the American public school system, as Summer and I did, although I can't even speak for Summer.
Wow. And it's a different animal today than it was when we went through school.
That's so true. That's true. We were in school mostly in the 80s and early 90s. So for us, okay, for me, reading about or learning about the revolution or however that happened, whichever little bits of knowledge or information I got over the years, whatever grade that was, okay? For me, even in college, although less so in college, learning about the revolution, the little facts that I had as a child growing up, it was very much, and there's no, I don't want to say there's nothing wrong with it because I don't want to get into that conversation. Understandably, when you learn about the beginning of your own nation, right? Being an American child, or at least being raised in an American school system, public school system, you're going to learn facts a certain way. You're going to learn certain point of view. I'm not saying it's wrong what the point of view was. I'm just saying you're going to learn something because you have to look at who's, you know, sharing, who's teaching you, right? Who wrote the history books? Now, I'm not saying the history is wrong. What I'm saying is that you're going to learn that the Patriots, you know, were brave and courageous and all of these things. Absolutely. You know, that's what we're growing up with. So I guess I'm trying to say we are raised, at least Summer and I were raised, I believe, to believe that not just the forefathers, right? Like Washington, all of those people. But we were raised to believe that the average man and woman, right, were so put upon that they wanted their own country. They didn't want to pay taxes that they felt were
Well, I mean, and these were taxes that were not, like, we pay taxes now. And ideally, in a perfect world, the taxes you pay go to support your communities and go to support the places that you live. In this time period, all their taxes were going back to England. And they were in no way supporting the communities and the colonies and the things that were growing here. So it's not the way that we envision taxes being paid today.
Now, I am not an expert in colonial America, let alone the taxation system back then. But yes, we all have heard taxation without representation, Boston Tea Party, all of that. So I'm not saying, who knows, some of the taxes may have been, I don't know, come back locally. I don't know. But yes, I understand that there was a huge problem, a huge inequality there. And I'll leave it at that. There was a huge, probably financial inequality as far as the haves, the have-nots. But, you know, that's been around since the beginning of time. So the reason I'm saying all of this is because I don't want to say it was one-sided, but it was, or maybe it was one-sided. I don't know. We are raised with the facts of the revolution, right? With the history. This happened in there. This happened here. There was this, da, da, da. And of course, as young American children, we are primed to be on the side of the revolutionaries, right? Who wouldn't be? At least growing up here, who wouldn't be? And I'm not saying I'm not. However, the show, I think, does a really good job at showing us that while there may have been taxation without representation, there may have been unfair taxes, and what they did to extract those taxes from people, well, they couldn't even extract them. In the book, for example, which they didn't keep thus far, one of the people that they meet at this decades-long gathering, just kidding, one of the people who, and I forget his name, but one of the guys who comes to the gathering is like dead to the world. Like he's like gaunt, he's not doing well. And they find out that he's lost his wife and his children. And they were like, well, what happened? Well, it wasn't a redcoat. It was a tax collector came around to collect the tax and they didn't have it. And so they were put out of their home. He, his wife, and their two children. Well, long story short, one of the children or some children were already buried, but she had at least one. His wife dies And so he loses everything because they can't keep their home because they can't afford to keep their home. So that obviously that is dramatic. And that shows you someone on the receiving end, right, of bad policy, the receiving end of inhumane practices, in my opinion. And that's in the book. And I'm sure something like that is not impossible that it happened. But the show, I think, does a good job at what many people might think is and is. And I think the show does a good thing at doing two things in one. And that is by showing the tarring and feathering, right? By showing Murta and the regulators and everyone, you know, and the Hillsborough. This was from the book, at least. This was in Hillsborough. That's completely from the book. And these were known as the Hillsborough riots, if I'm not mistaken. So when these things happen, right? It's the people taking in charge of their own futures or whatever. But what are they doing? They are, if not killing, they are scarring these men for the rest of their life. They're torturing them. This is. I don't think this is acceptable. Now, at a human level, I'm not saying because, but it, obviously, it's historical. So what I'm trying to say is, it's really easy, especially as an American who was schooled here, right? Who was educated here. It's really easy for me to, in general, choose a side and say regulators, right? Or regulars, excuse me, revolutionaries. We're not quite there yet historically in the show, but this is why it comes to be. Ultimately, these little pockets of riots, this kind of thing is happening all over the colonies. So they're doing a good job, right? I think. But they show us two things with this one. They show us, as I said, these little pockets of what's going on, what will ultimately lead to the revolution. But also, they show us how no one side is all good or all bad. Like I said, I kind of started to hate Murta a little bit. And mm-hmm. I don't hate him. I don't like that I felt that. But when people are begging for mercy, you show it. You show it. And that's going to be a difference of opinion, I'm sure, with a lot of people. But I just think it's very important to think critically. And as an 8-year-old or a 6-year-old, of course, I couldn't have this, right? And you're not meant to think that much higher level yet. But I think as someone who does love our country and who wants America to be the best, and I'm not trying to get political, I promise, but as someone who wants her country to be the best it can be and also be the best for its citizens and for its residents, the best that it can be for all of us here. It's so important to remember that no one side of anything is all good.
True. But also you hear that, like you said, you hear the term tar and feather, but the reality of it was really hard. It was so hard to watch.
That's what I'm trying to say. When we're in elementary school and you hear tar and feather, you know what I think? I think of pillows and stuffed animals.
No. I'm thinking like rubber cement.
Oh,
rubber cement and feathers. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
it's burning. But
it's boiling tar.
It's boiling
pitch.
Tar because that's the only way that it's movable. So yeah, so that has to be hot to stick and create the thing. But I don't know. And then when they poured it over that guy's head, I was just like, he's not coming back from that. He's not coming back from that. And they said he may still succumb from his wounds. Of course he's going to succumb to his wounds. They poured it on his head.
I can't. That just makes me like my stomach. Exactly. My stomach just like, oh, God.
It was gross.
So, and, oh, that was hard to watch.
Like the way that they did it, though, was between the lighting.
I know.
Of how it was.
Because and the it was dark and candlelit. With the fake steam and everything.
With
yeah.
the fake steam. And then with the... I think it was CGI, or maybe I was inventing it with my brain, but it looked like the skin around where the tar went immediately turned like hot red.
Like, yeah, probably so, would have.
Oh, no, it absolutely would have. What I'm saying is I don't know if they actually did that or if my brain was making that happen. Awful. Awful. Yeah, and as someone who's...
I'm good, stars. We don't need that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And having to watch it a few times was not make it any easier.
Yeah.
So now here's a new question. especially against what we just talked about, right? Now we're kind of grossed out and I hate Murta just a little bit. And we go straight from that into this, going from that violence into this hymn sounding rendition of the Sky Boat song, which is kind of churchy, which it's growing on me. I like it. It's very off-putting, Stars. I know that's supposed to be, but I will say I didn't notice. I went through scene by scene, whatever. I didn't notice any new images in the opening, in the intro.
No. You know, what makes me so angry is we didn't have in the books, and I know people hate it when we're like, the books. And I'm not saying the books are better. I'm not.
It's an observation.
We didn't, and this, and you'll see where I'm going with this. We didn't have a character on the side of the regulators.
Correct.
In the books. So we didn't have any real reason
to root for them.
Yep. And to be fair right now, I'm not particularly rooting for them because to me, it feels like they are being portrayed exactly the way the English government would have portrayed them.
Portrayed as terrorists. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That's why I said at the beginning when I finished my little monologue, they too. Nothing. And this is why I said I'm not trying to get political and I'm not mentioning any politics. But whatever you're looking at, unless, and this is not a projection, this is just, again, my opinion, unless you happen to believe in the divine, unless you happen to believe in a higher power, okay? Other than that, ain't nothing on this earth with, next to, inside, outside, I don't care. Nothing that humans touch or that humans are involved in. No sides of any argument, no parties, nothing is 100% good. Nothing. Nothing. So that's why I brought
it
back
to. I'm at least 98% good.
Oh, Summer. Well, you could be mostly good, but I'm talking more about like organizations more than individuals.
I know.
But yeah, and that's why I mentioned our education, you and I at least, is because you're brought up to think of the Patriots as can do no wrong. Well, I'm sorry.
That's the history. History is being told by the winners.
I know that.
And I think that history's way of doing that is a loss. It's really a great loss for everyone now.
Because then you end up hating Murta.
Well, no. I mean, that is a direct result of this one moment. However,
yes.
the larger conversation is that, for instance, when we read stuff like this about, you know, the Jacobites and all of those things, and then we go to places now, like Culloden, and you go through and you hear you have this connection that you've created with these rebels, these Jacobites, right? You have this connection you've created with them because of the story of the people and what their goals were and how they felt downtrodden and as a country not created but founded upon rebellion, right? We feel for the little guy. And we want to fight for them. You know, we feel, you know, they have a right to have what's theirs and this, that, and the other. And then you go to places like Culloden and you listen to the audio as you walk around and they always call the British people the government troops. And I'm always like, the government troops? Because I forget that they're now.
Yeah, it's not Scottish English.
Exactly. So it's, again, history being told by the winners. So, but it does a disservice to history at large because so many nuances and broader tales are lost in that.
With that, the opening title is, we find out later. You know right away. If you know her hands and her rings, you know it's Claire. Claire baking bread and Rhea crooning over it.
I mean, sure, but all I was like, bread.
I know, right? I'll take a loaf for three.
I've gotten really into sourdough recently, and I have like a sourdough starter and stuff. So
I'm a little disappointed, y'all listeners. She has not shared this with me, and neither has. Well, I know you were doing something. She has not shared any bread with me. Please rectify that, Summer.
All right, I can get on that. So I have a sourdough starter that I feed and take care of. I haven't named it yet. I should. I've had it for like 4 years, but and I'm looking at that, and that bread looks a lot like like the sourdough kind of breads that you would make. But there is no way that you could make that many loaves of like legit sourdough bread without yeast, like without extra yeast overnight. Because like my just sourdough starter rolls, loaves that I do, they take to get that nice, good
crust
and to get them. Well, the baking itself is only like an hour. It's the rising time because sourdough and natural yeast takes a lot longer to rise. So, I mean, I could have my sourdough rising for 10 hours. So I don't know. And I don't know what she's using for yeast. She may have a whole different kind of yeast that she's using out there. But there is no way you could get that quantity of bread risen and baked overnight. Unless she's got special yeast in the big house.
It's called she has special Hollywood in the house.
That's a lot of bread. You spend a third of your life in sheets. Don't you want them to be insanely comfortable?
And this new year, it's time to get comfortable. Like with new bedding, loungewear, towels, and more.
Founded in early 2014 by husband and wife Vicky and Rich Fulop, who wanted to find beautiful home essentials that didn't cost an arm and a leg, with a mission to make you comfortable.
They've moved beyond the bedroom to offer essentials for your bathroom, like towels, shower curtains, and bath mats, and even launched ultra-soft loungewear that makes you feel like you never left your bed. Now, as we've spoken about, I think, every other time, in regard to Brooklinen, I still love sleeping in my Brooklinen sheets. They're the softest set I own, and I love that it's white. It still goes with all my bedroom decor, and if I want, I can mix and match it with other sets.
And the only thing that makes me sad about my sheets is that I only have one set. So they're in between. Laundry week is the worst week of my life, because then I have to switch out my Brooklinen sheets for another set of sheets while I wash them, and that is the saddest day.
So do you like softness or comfort? Essentials to help you relax. Brooklinen has it all. Brooklinen.com is the perfect place to hit refresh in the new year. Go on, make yourself comfortable.
Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, loungewear, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping on all new sheet when you use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com.
And hey, New Yorkers, if you're listening, you can get the internet's favorite sheets and more in real life. Visit Brooklinen's first store in Brooklyn at 127 Kent Avenue in Williamsburg. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. So the one of the ways thus far that we're shown, Bree deals with her PTSD. What happened to her is by drawing. And as she does that, you can see her face and her hand getting really intense. And then someone comes screaming up in a carriage. It's a wife and with her husband.
It's the sketching emergency.
Oh, Lord. Yes. the one that I said when we watched, I think it was when we were in Atlanta
the wrong, trailer.
When I said they're reminding us. Yeah. Somerset sketching emergency. And I'm like, they're reminding us that Bree draws. Because it was odd to see her just running with it, but now we understood she was already sitting, blah, blah, blah. So the husband of this man, Mr. and Mrs. Farish, he's been ill and she's tried to look after him, but he's taken a turn for the worse. And so they get in their carriage and go to the big house. It's a Mistress Farish and we see Mr. and Mrs. Bug. Now, this is not, we don't know if it's a character change yet, but thus far it's not major. But in the books, again, I think we're just going to have to just say we give up. We can't help but the fact that we know certain things. Mr. Bug specifically, and it was part of his character, was not a talker. Mrs. Bug was a major talker.
I mean, I haven't heard a word come out of Mr. Bug.
Oh, he spoke when they, I think he went up. He was one of the ones to go meet the little with a wagon or whatever. And I could have sworn he said something.
Even if he did, just because he said something, I mean, why wouldn't he say something? Just because being a man of few words doesn't mean he never speaks.
Oh, he speaks in the books, but it's not often. And not that this is not important, but it definitely wouldn't have, I'm not saying he wouldn't have done this, but it just surprised me. That's all I'm saying. So also, we're introduced to the surgery. I mean, this surgery had its own wards. It has private beds. I mean, wow.
It's a big house.
This is It's called a big surgery within an even bigger house. Claire does her best to find out what's going on, but in the end, the guy dies.
Here's the thing that I was thinking when I was watching this, because yes, clearly there was nothing she could do to stop him from dying. But wouldn't it have done better for her to have at least looked like she tried something? Like, just have somebody show up with a patient and be like, sorry, there's nothing I can do. And have them be like, you're not going to try anything? And then everyone just stands around and watches him take his last breath. The least she could have done is made it look like she was trying. If he died during it, at least she was trying, as opposed to, nope, nothing I can do. All I can do is stand here.
She was trying to take his vitals and find out as much information as she could at taking his history. And as soon as she said blue pills, Claire's like, I'm out. He's dead.
So, but the blue pills aren't what killed him.
No, it all brought his death on sooner, but he would have died eventually from the septicemia once his the infection, once his appendix burst. But she didn't know that at that point.
What does it do? How does it instill confidence in the people she's trying to help if she doesn't even look like she's trying to help them? I'm just saying, you're a fine healer, but you're not that guy over at Cross Creek, and you're not a medical professional, and you don't know all the things. So, I mean, I'm not saying she's going to save and or heal everyone, but it might go a few extra yards in getting what she wants, which means people to do what she wants, if it looks like she actually does something. And that doesn't instill in people that they should bring him here sooner. If she'd tried and then said, if he'd only been brought sooner, maybe at the first onset of that, you should blah. But this to me just looked like she was like, nope, hands out. I don't want anything to do with this.
I don't think she had much. I thought she was trying. She was trying to gather information. And then the guy was like, I mean, he dies a few minutes later, but I think she was trying. She wasn't going to like cut him open or anything, but well, at least with people there. And as he dies, or in this situation, not even as he dies, as her mother is collecting information about what he took, what his history was, Bree's face is awful to watch because she's watching her mom and listening to this. And she's like, oh, she knows exactly what this is. Once the woman, the wife is saying, you know, oh, I did this and this and this and this. So then the next scene out is outside. The redcoats are still there. And was it just me, or did it seem Lieutenant Knox was a little bit into Jamie? I mean, I get it. Everyone is.
I feel like it's a bromance. I don't think he's into him like that.
No, just that's kind of what I meant. So everyone is. And even Bree would be, except incest. So he's just talking up Jamie so much. Like, I wish I had this kind of land. I think once we do this, yes, I'll get this piece of land.
You're right, but he's not a colonel.
Yeah, so he's a little sucking up.
So he's...
Oh, well, I wrote, is he blowing smoke? Not as in lying, but in trying to impress him. That's what I was getting at.
Well, to me, that felt like he has been given rewards and respect from Tryon that Knox has not yet. So Jamie has all these accolades and has done almost nothing to earn them, right? Like it was he was paid in advance on the promise of future actions. Whereas this gentleman has not been given anything. He's just a government soldier, and he's just there to toe the line and make sure that everyone's doing what they're doing. But he doesn't have their rank, and he doesn't have any of the benefits that Jamie has been given and granted by the governor. So I think he's looking for, he wants him, Jamie, to reflect positively on him to Governor Tryon, as well as him being there to make sure that Jamie's doing what he's supposed to be doing. So, I mean, it's like it's almost like the governor is judging both of the men by each other. Like, he's using each of the men to get what he wants from the other.
Yeah, Knox is left there to make sure Jamie does his job, but also Knox knows Jamie has like a higher position rank and a higher and more, like, he's already, like as you said, gotten these accolades. So almost like Knox obviously wants to impress Tryon, but he also definitely kind of wants to impress Jamie.
And Jamie's been living in a vacuum. Like, he's been out in the woods with just his people, building his house and doing his thing and sending missives. But all of the things that Murta's people have been doing and that the regulators and the colonists and everyone have been doing has been, he's only heard about. So hearing about something and seeing the result of it are two different things. So I think that this mission also drove that home for Jamie, that this is what's really on the line. This isn't just people talking, and this isn't just unrest. This is like violence.
Does anyone recognize the music under the conversation? It sounded like, I didn't recognize a theme, but it sounded like horns. And even though it wasn't the Lord John theme, makes me think that I think they use horns, and which would make sense with, you know, horns, hunt, soldiers, that kind of thing, at least at this time. So that didn't surprise me. And it happened several times. When Jamie says that he'll be sure to mention the affable lieutenant in his next dispatch.
Lieutenant.
Yes. Knox gives him a knowing smile. And I wrote, gracious. And then Knox flirts some more. Quote, I can only hope to one day be granted a parcel of land half so nice as yours. Unquote. That was flattery. And then, quote, maybe once we hang Fitzgibbons, maybe then Tryon will be so kind.
And who knows if it was real.
Step off.
If it was real smoke, you know, if he's really feels those things, or if he's a master manipulator and trying to get to the, and everything, if you put everything that happens in this episode through that lens, you can see Hamilton in a much more nefarious light.
Yes, but the reason I don't think so is because I don't think Hamilton gains anything if he's acting that way by killing that dude.
But what he gains is seeing how Jamie reacts. So if, and all of those people were bound for the hangman's noose anyway, so killing one early isn't going to make him, get him in trouble with the governor, right? That's just one less regulator they have to worry about. But seeing how Jamie reacts and what results from
can
it.
Can be a test, yeah.
Can be a test, could be a test.
The wee party takes off. Knox tries to be a mensch and drops money on some people on the side of the road. And a dude spits at them.
But that's just a dick move anyway. I mean, it's like if...
Yeah.
That would be like
here,
if you're
take
walking
my
down.
Money.
No. If you're walking down the street today and there's a homeless person there or someone who's in need and you throw money at their feet, like it's one thing if he handed somebody money, but like throwing coins at somebody, that's rude.
Knox numerous times includes Jamie in we. He's men like you and me. And quote, perhaps when we hang Fitzgibbons. Jamie tries to find this common ground, protecting those we were sworn to defend. Does Knox sniff a little bit of sympathy for the regulators? Jamie's all, nah. Sympathy for those who are put upon. So he tries to, he's literally, as this episode is called, Jamie is doing that dance. Like Jamie has, he is in a very precarious situation. A rioter comes up to report a riot in Hillsborough, and that's where that's where the tarring and feathering happen, and that's where they're on their way to. And this is the one we saw in the beginning of the episode. So Claire takes advantage of the convenient dead dude in her surgery to practice her autopsy skills. Bree comes by for a chat.
Nasty. Nasty for several reasons. One, they don't have the preservation ability that we do today. So that thing smells awful. It smells.
He's full of, like,
he was already rotting and septic inside.
Full of infection. Yeah.
That doesn't smell good. One.
No.
Two, it's just literally rotting. They're, even if they have him in a cold room, that body without, you know, the preservation ways that we do today is not going to be viable for long. Everything is going to break down.
That's why it's important that she gets this stuff done.
Yeah, but how many days had passed before she brought Marsley into it?
Well, we don't know. It could have been later. It could have been all one day. So Bree comes by for a chat and we all think, oh, is she pregnant again?
I didn't
because
think that.
Because she has like her gorge rises. But of course it would. Claire promises her that she won't get caught. And she confirms through her autopsy, she had confirmed that Mr. Farish had appendicitis.
And Ginger, you didn't see this because you don't have the Stars app, but this is there will be no other autopsy in the season. So they brought this autopsy up.
Yeah. So this is Betsy.
Yes.
Betty.
But yeah, there will be no ground glass autopsy.
Claire defends her butchery. Bree has to peace out. It's okay, Bree. We all kind of wanted to peace out from this scene. And then we're shown Marsley butchering a deer.
A deer's butt.
They make eye contact. She impresses Claire with her skill. Now Claire is getting flirty thoughts of Marsley.
Flirty thoughts? Really?
I will follow that up and I will defend it. Absolutely.
Because nothing like cutting an animal's butt open makes me want to bring them into my surgery.
You're not a surgeon. Hillsborough.
She's not a butt surgeon.
Oh, Summer. Hillsborough. The aftermath. People are cleaning up. It's a pretty good poster child, this city, what's happened in the aftermath for keeping the British around, or at worst, going to hunt those regulators. Mr. Fanning, who'd escaped pretty lightly, takes the man's to see one of the men who had been tarred and feathered, quote, for enforcing a tax that they did not want to pay, unquote. So, as I said earlier, the punishment of tarring and feathering does not fit the crime of people wanting to hurt you or whatever because you're not paying their taxes. But it's like I said, it's neither of the things. You can look at any of the quote unquote punishments and none of them, I don't believe, fit the crime. Putting someone out of their house is not fitting the crime. You know, that's not. Can't get onto that tangent. So, it's a little deeper than that, but I'll let it go for now since you're actually wounded, Mr. Man. Fanning wishes Claire was with him. Gracious, everyone is wishing up on everyone else's significant others. Step off. I'm just going to say regs because that's what I wrote. Three regs were captured. Fanning takes Knox and Jamie to the jail, which is actually pretty sweet. Like the jail was, I mean, not a jail. Jails aren't sweet, but it was like well built. It was a pretty good size. Was Murtagh among the jailed? Let's go find out. Jamie is relieved to see that Murtagh isn't part of them. And the three do look pretty pissy though. They give Jamie lots of guff. And Lieutenant Knox goes crazy and guts the middle one. After he spits on him, obviously. There's a lot of blood in this episode. I was like, damn, people. I'd rather have the sex. Because I don't mean just me personally. That's not, I'm not trying to get personal. I just mean I'd rather have sex in an episode than a lot of violence. But it's at the time. I'm not poo-pooing it, but dang.
Well, but then, you know, everyone gets judged by the cause and not by their own merits.
Yeah.
So
it's hard.
I think that was the overreaction of the century to being spit on.
Totally.
And I think he died rather quickly from a stomach wound.
That's true. So I thought, yeah, that I noticed that too. And as far as overreaction for being spit upon, he must be, I mean, yes, it was absolutely. But remember, he was already, or even though it didn't hit him, they were already spit at least once when he tried to give money to that dude. So,
but not on. On is a different animal altogether, but
I understand. But it's also the way you're being treated.
I know.
Like,
but
I just tried to give you money and you spit on me or spit at me, you ungracious wackadoodle.
But he also already had the sword out. So
yeah, no, that's true.
I think that when you've started your one up match, because that's what was happening.
You gotta be ready.
And once the sword is out, there's really, outside of what he did, other than putting it back away, there's no, which is really the opposite message that he was trying to send. There's really no one-upping taking your sword out other than, you know, stabbing some dude or using it in that way.
And Jamie, after this, I mean, he kind of has to, given the circumstance, given the where he's at and who's there. Jamie even stands up for Knox because, you know, saving face. After admonishing him for killing the dude. So he's like, Knox, what are you doing, man? You just did this. Da, da, da. You just acted as judge and jury and executioner. for this dude. And the people, or the two who are left, see this, not what he tells to, not his admonishing Knox, but when he says, you know, that guy shouldn't have egged him on. They see Jamie as at least previously one of them. And all the things they say are like, you have the land, you have the money, you have the position, you know, they are basically using all the descriptors. They call Jamie a traitor in everything but name, basically a traitor to his people. Oh my gosh. What is that from? A traitor to his people. If I am, then let it be.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Traitor to your country. We are talking of life or death, man. We are talking of being free, Miss Saigon, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. I got a lot of those this episode. We just haven't come up around them yet.
Well, what struck me is the fact that poor Jamie is really just there as a witness. And that's what it comes down to in the end of it, because he's stuck between, I mean, the two fires. Even if the two fires are just the people that were arrested and the soldier standing next to him, is that everyone is behaving badly. And I feel like Jamie's just like, guys, can't we just get along right now? This is not what's necessary. I want to keep everyone safe because these British soldiers are just doing what they're told. And that's the state of a soldier. And you guys don't like it. And you guys are just doing what you're told, which is, tax is bad. Kill the people with taxes. So it's like, I feel like he's just standing there going, come on, guys. Come on. Is this necessary? Can't we all just, you know, not pull our swords out and stab each other? That'd be awesome.
Then we are taken to Roger and Bree practicing shooting. Also from the book. Even the turkeys are from the book. Not quite exactly, but it was pretty close. And I learned about a new Scottish or British, I don't know if it was UK-wide, character named Tufty Fluffytail. Mm. Roger thinks Bree's keeping him occupied by doing target practice, and he's mostly right. And yeah, he is right-ish, but not that he's... And yeah, he is right that he's not really there to do all the protecting. Let's just be honest. Roger was not left behind to protect the ridge. He was left behind to protect himself.
To sing at the funeral.
Well, that's just a Benny. Mm. He was left behind to protect himself because he's not ready. He may never be ready, but he's not ready to face any kind of battle yet. Now, I want to know, did they really shoot at turkeys? And did they really kill one for the show? Because that something really did make one fall down kind of upside down.
It could be a trained turkey.
Oh, Lord.
They have horses that are trained to fall. So, I mean, I don't know.
I have to imagine.
But if
I
they want turkeys, we have tons of wild ones here that are crossing streets in the middle of traffic if they want to come and pick up some of these.
I am curious. Usually if there's a show with any animals in it, or especially like battle scenes and that kind of thing.
Did it end with no animals were injured in the...
I didn't watch all the credits.
Okay.
Well, I only watched the credits far enough to see the people who were not the stars of the show, but the people who were actually there. Like we learn about, we met the bugs last week, right? We didn't know because they weren't introduced. So yeah, I only now make a point to get that far. And after that, I don't. But I might go back and just see. I'm sure they didn't do it. At least if they may have used, like obviously they had a dead deer that she was chopping, but they didn't. They probably used, I don't even know. I'm not going to go there. But I'm sure that they didn't do it for the show, as in kill it on camera.
I wonder though if they found... One of the other thoughts that I had was that if they'd found like old footage that someone else that already existed, but then they had to make it high def so that it fit in with the look of the show.
Now we get to the real convo. Roger wants to go back, doesn't he? And right here we hear a little bit of the Roger and Bree theme. He understands that she does not want to leave her family, because right where she's at right now, she has her entire world, right? Everyone is there. Roger, to be honest, it's the same because although he has no one or had no one in his once the Reverend died, he had no one, right, that he knows of. But right now he is with the only family that he has, Bree and the baby and his extended family. When the scene with Knox starts and he says, "What have I done?" I, of course, thought, "What have I done, sweet Jesus? What have I done? Become a thief in the night, become a dog on the run." And I won't go any further.
It. You should have stopped it before you started it.
No, I'm not going to. No, I got to do it. But I'm done now. So this is called, or I called it anyway, Lieutenant Knox's soliloquy.
He's not a Javert.
No, that was Valjean.
Oh, was it? No.
I thought it was Javert too. I looked it up. No, it's Jean Valjean. Become a thief in the night, become a dog on the run. Da, da, da. It's just after he steals the silver from the l'évêque, the bishop. He hates what he's done. Yes, he's a hypocrite. You're right, Knox. Drink up. And we have more low horns.
Drink up. Drink up so that I can go set all the other prisoners free.
Exactly. And there are more low horns as they talk. So whenever we get Jamie and Knox alone in this episode, at least. So the theme is battle. The theme is talking of, or at least with Knox being there, his presence, the theme is soldiers, war, battle, that kind of thing. Hence, at least at this time in history, or in our world of Outlander, 18th century British, we are getting the horns. It makes a lot of sense. I'm guessing like army sounds, kind of, as I said, like in the Lord John theme, but it's not the same theme.
If you're looking for a fun way to pass the time while engaging your brain and enjoying breathtaking visuals and a gripping story, your answer is Best Fiends.
Best Fiends is a casual game that anyone can play, but made for adults. You can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. Now, I'm currently at level 50 or 51, I'm in my early 50s. Early 50s. One thing I've noticed since our last visit from Best Fiends is that I took your suggestion, Summer, and I've started playing it more while waiting. Maybe not in line like at the grocery store, but like in a place where you're sitting, like at the doctor's office. It's so easy to get lost in. I also like the bright colors, and I like that it's very well designed. It's visually stimulating. Yes, it's a fun and not distracting, but it allows me to, I guess, distract myself, like I said, while waiting, rather than just like, you know, mindlessly scrolling social media or something like that. How about you, Sam?
I am currently on, don't be upset, 457.
We knew after the first time we had a visit from Best Fiends, you're always going to be ahead of me.
I know. I'm not kidding you guys. I play this game at least once a day, and I'm not going to tell you how long I play when I play. But what I like about it is that I can do – it doesn't require all of my focus. You know what I mean? It's a game that I can casually play while I'm doing other things. Like if I'm watching a movie with my kid that I'm not super interested in, but I know she's going to ask me about later, I can play this game during the movie and still get enough from the movie that I can come back to it. But it's great for me because it totally engages my puzzle mind, because I like puzzles. And for me, the puzzle in this is how can I get the most color matches in one move? I want to make them the bigger they are. And the bigger they are, the more points you get, and points are the point, right? Also, it's full of these cute little characters that each have special powers and things like one of the bugs clears an entire horizontal row. Another one, if you have this bug, clears, he'll do like a round circle, like he'll clear it in specific patterns, and other ones where they turn other colors. So, I mean, there is an advantage. You want to get more bugs because you want to have more options to beating a level, because some levels you can't win without specific bugs, and I am way too into it.
Yeah, but I think it's a healthy thing to be way too
into. Oh, for sure. I mean, it doesn't take over my life. I can totally quit anytime.
Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile app game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
He tells Jamie that the other two will go to New Bern to be hanged. And he thinks that the way he ran the one man through was better than he deserved. He's like, I gave him a soldier's ending, a soldier's death. Well, then.
I mean, he didn't say it like that.
No, but he said,
He said the words. The words you said are true, but he didn't say it like he was hitting on somebody.
Oh, Summer, I wasn't trying to.
I gave him a soldier's death.
You're reading sex into what I said, how I said it. I am not trying to have it read sex. My point is.
Okay, NPR.
Stop it. NPR is exactly. not sex.
You just said it again. Stop it.
Stop, Summer.
Better.
Anyway, well then, remind me to leave before you wake up because I don't want to be killed by you. I love, as I already mentioned, I love that we're getting more of Roger singing. Finally, it needs to be like, can't say too much, but it needs to be like this in every episode. So far, we're 2 for 2. Then they bury a casket. And during this little funeral, Marsley is holding Wee Joni. Bree is holding Wee Gem. So now the fandom can relax and say, yes, it's 2 babies. And Marsley is pregnant with number 3.
All the babies.
Here's the thing. Isn't Marsley busy enough
having babies?
She's caring for 2 babies, has a baby on the way, a husband with 1 hand. And she's doing like all of the work because he can only do so much with 1 hand. Doesn't she have enough on her plate? Isn't she busy enough? I know it's not nearly as exciting as being an apprentice to the healer on the ridge, but doesn't she have enough? Who's going to pick up the slack for her house when she's doing Claire stuff?
That's going to be
not one-handed Fergus.
Star's going to have to answer that question.
And Germain is too young to help much around the house.
Claire makes googly eyes at Marsley. She even gets Fergs to look after the bebis while she takes away his wife. Something I want to show you. Do you trust me? Unquote.
Don't. She gonna show anything with Claire that starts with you trust me is gonna end in us having to look at a dead body.
Yes. So she says, basically, these are my words, not hers, but come look, my precious. One look as she sexily folds back the drape of the dead Mr. Farish.
Not sexy.
And she doesn't get quite the reaction she wants out of Marsley. Marsley says, Lord have mercy.
To be fair, Marsley should have smelled that answer coming.
Oh, that's
the second
funny.
She opened the door. She knew what was under that sheet.
She screams, and Claire has to cover her mouth before someone comes in to see what's going on. And then Marsley, like, I love it. I love Marsley, honestly. And we kind of said this at the red carpet, and I need to get those videos out so you can see. Look, I think Lauren Lyle is my new favorite on the show. I mean, she's just as spunky as Marsley, or I should say, the reason Marsley is so spunky and BA is because of Lauren Lyle. Because Lauren Lyle, like, that is, I imagine that is Lauren Lyle. Like, that's, she's friendly. She's, she's just my one of my favorites from the red carpet. She says to Claire, was she right? My mom? Mm-hmm. And Claire knows exactly where it's going. She's like, I'm not a witch. And this is my words. Really, Claire? Because this is why people think you're a witch. Then we find out the casket was empty, save for the rocks. And Claire goes from witchy, quote, we can learn the secrets from the dead. And, quote, we physicians, we learn from practicing on the dead. To churchy. Oh, that's to come. Now, as she tells Marsley, she thinks she'd make a good apprentice. Then she flatters her, quote, I've seen you butchering.
I saw you with that deer butt.
Exactly. Now for churchy Claire. Mm-hmm. After the big reveal, when she sexily pulled that thing back, Marsley says, God have mercy. And Claire replies after a beat, well, I believe he does. It's a miraculous thing, the human body. And I want to use this body to teach you.
Except for this bit here. No one needs that.
So that we can protect God's miracle. She finishes without being able to quite look Marsley straight in the eye. And then she's back to flattering, quote, you are kind and caring and have the right instincts. And then the truth comes out. I need help. Just lead with that, Claire. Be honest. Don't flatter or be all churchy because you ain't. Explain. She explains how autopsy is different from defilement.
So here's the thing. Uh-oh. If autopsy is really different from defilement, couldn't any serial killer just say, I was trying to learn the secrets of the body?
Stop.
I mean, because it all looks the same in the end, right? A butchered body.
Yeah. I mean,
and I'm really upset that I had to think Bree was the voice of reason. Bree is never the voice of reason. How is she the voice of reason?
Oh, that's
every
funny.
Time. Any scene she was in, she's like, we can't do this. That's not smart. It's because what, Jamie's not there to tell her it's not smart. So we had to have someone.
Back to Hillsborough. After the body's been taken away, that one that died really quickly, Jamie goes in and releases the two remaining rags. He says Knox should not have done what he did, but they should not have riled him up. Jamie is trying to, ride's the wrong word. He's trying to, as we say, you know, as the episode is called, walk between two fires. It's very difficult for Jamie,
Back to the ridge.
The first scene, are they like chopping? It looks like they're chopping animal fat at first. And then we see that another little area. Or maybe
actually, rendered yeah,
so,
fat.
Because they're making candles. Mm-hmm. So it's like a community day on the ridge. Those trees are so gorgeous. They have all the candles hanging from the trees. It's like, man, I just want to be on that set. It's so beautiful. The candle women are talking about different home remedies. And when Claire dares insert herself, she's very kindly booted out because she's not a trained physician. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And she's taking a new turn. The next scene is her taking a new turn, as Dr. Rawling recommends. I think that was a good ad. That was an interesting idea. I want to speculate. Do you think she will end up getting in trouble when these things that she's copying out get around? Do you think her doing this as Dr. Rawlings recommends will bite her in the butt?
I don't think this is the thing.
Oh, you don't think this will get her in trouble?
No.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Of all the things she's doing, I don't think that is the thing.
Okay.
I think there are way too many more things to come. We are on episode 2.
So apparently, okay, we don't know. By the end of the episode, they haven't buried the body yet, right?
They need to very soon. That thing is...
My question is, they haven't done it yet, right? That we know of.
Correct.
Okay, so it looks like we are being led to believe that the body makes it at least till the next episode. So anyway, in this episode, at least they didn't show us what they did, but they talked about it. So maybe they have handled it. But I would think she couldn't, like, you know, leave the body to just fester, right?
Or well, it's going to have to be resolved by next week, because next week they're leaving the ridge.
Okay. So all this to say, if this is their only autopsy, right? And we're not going to go into, because there is an autopsy in the book. It is not under these conditions. Well, I'll put it that way. So if this is the only autopsy, then someone other than Bree and Marsley have to see it. Because Bree and Marsley aren't going to get Claire in trouble.
Well, that's if she gets in trouble for it.
Well, that's true. It may not be. I'm just saying. So it could be the Dr. Rawling recommends. It could be the autopsy or the body.
Or it could be something that hasn't happened yet. So let's just keep moving.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. But so far, we have two possibilities.
I don't think episode 2. I don't think whatever is going to be the thing that carries over into next season has already been introduced.
So back in Hillsborough, Mr. Fanning will look into who did the breaking out. Was it another reg? Jamie says it might be in their favor. Lieutenant Knox says you need more men. The men on the ridge that you gathered there with your community were not enough. So, and I wrote this because I haven't seen that whole sneak peek of season two of the next episode. They will be heading to Brownsville. So the way we got there will have been different, but they go there for the same reason. And that is to call up a militia, because that's why they went to Brownsville in the book. And so next week should be crazy. Fun. So yeah, maybe not episode 1, but episode 2, and it sounds like episode 3, are going to be bloody. Blech. And he says, come prepared for war. Also from the book, but slightly different. Roger is short-sighted in the left eye. That's what she says. She doesn't say near or far. So I thought that was interesting. In one eye, in his left eye. It's slightly different from the book.
Pretty sure short-sighted means nearsighted.
Probably, but she says short. I'm just saying, she didn't say near or far. So the reason, or not the reason, we don't know the reason. The way it's different from the book is, and I don't know why they didn't want to talk about it. Maybe it was too much science rather than just saying, oh, you're a little near or farsighted. Because I remember this discussion too when we had in our read along. I was talking about how Roger had a, because she goes further to say, she asks him more questions like, did you wear glasses as a child? Because if this is caught early, it can be corrected in childhood. And he says, yeah, I had a pair of glasses and I lost them a few times. And we, after a few times, it's like, it was too expensive. We just didn't, you know, continue with them. So it never was fully healed or fully fixed in childhood. And the reason it's so interesting to me is because they don't say the word, but she talks about, I believe in the book, talks about prisms. Or the thing that's lenses. And that would be convergence insufficiency. And that's what I have. And I talked about that in our episode in the read along. And so I guess they just didn't want to have it be that complicated. They're like, let's just make him nearsighted. Whatever. Another Les Mis reference. Claire tells Roger to look down, look down. Okay. So a great reference. Roger's father, Jerry McKenzie, and this is all coming through this conversation, right? We're reminded of Roger's father, Jerry McKenzie, who was a Spitfire pilot in the war. He had no vision problems, which turns into, quote, I think she wants to stay. That's what the conversation ends with. And Claire brings us back to his many times great-grandparents. Well done. So in this scene, we are given, oh, Lord have mercy, they are setting up the season. They're giving us more Roger backstory and setting things up. And then Roger goes even further. Welp. Quote, though if we ever cross paths again, trying to explain to Moira McKenzie that we're kin may be tricky.
That's all right. Just kiss her.
Stop it. Claire agrees with him, or at least says she loves them being there. But she hopes that they don't stay. And under this conversation, a very light and short Dance of the Druids theme. And then we get little diddles of the Jamie and Claire love theme. Now, he makes a good point. Until they know if or whether Jem can hear the stones, they're stuck. Then we're off to the regulator camp. The two regs who were delivered. Delivered from evil. Oh, Lord. The two regs who were let go, who were freed from the jail, make their way back to Myrta. And as soon as they show this dude, I was like, oh, Herman Husband is a pirate.
The giant beard.
Yes, that's why just I thought he was a pirate.
He's a beard that talks Herman, from time to time.
Herman Beard. That's a large camp, dudes. Like, Myrta says that Jamie is right, though. He's like, they need to bide their time. And reminds them, the two men, that Jamie is walking between two fires. And Herman Husband's token friend line, and of course by friend, I mean Quaker. So his token friend line, quote, we pray it does not come to that, meaning the fighting. And Myrta promises that if and when the time comes, he will fight with them. So Myrta, freshly released from his oath to Jamie, has called his sides in case we had any doubt.
It's a game of chess and they want checkers.
Summer.
It's a larger game. You can't just go jumping everyone on the board. There's things at hand. You have to think of the end game and not just this move. And
maybe we actually know more than we think we know about that body, because back in the surgery, Claire's gone mad baking bread and she puts all those things with the glass covers on the surgery table, which is where the body was.
Roger moved it to the cellar. Did you miss that whole conversation?
I must have.
She said, thank you for helping me move the body to the cellar.
Oh, that's such a normal conversation.
I told you, he's the guy that would help you move a body.
That's funny. Claire is finally off to figure out penicillin land. Yay! Bree tells her mom she's playing God. And Claire's all, girl, we all do that. When I save a life, when you came back to save us, like, we all do that. Like, simmer down now. It's all good. We all do that.
How is she more upset at her mother for baking bread than cutting a body open and leaving it on her surgery? That's what I want to know. How?
Cutting the body doesn't, someone who's already dead, that had nothing to do with her mom, that's not changing. That's not playing God.
No, but the thing is, first of all, she doesn't invent penicillin. Penicillin has always been here. It's just not
discovered.
Right. So she's not inventing it. She would be discovering it or just finding it sooner than other people. And as long as she doesn't call it what it is, it won't really impact anything. And at this point, it's just bread.
It's just moldy bread. How is moldy bread more dangerous to Claire's future than a dead body that they're keeping that they pretended to bury? Okay, I'm making a prediction. I already kind of said it earlier. Roger will sing in every episode of the season, or most of them.
Not all of them.
They're definitely centering his vocals this season. It's a great job. And I love the Jeremiah. That was so sweet. The Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
But what will be his swan song?
And Jem is adorable. And so is Roger's tiny guitar.
It really is a small guitar. Oh. No, it's a, I would call that like maybe a travel guitar. Like people still have, there are still small guitars now. I mean, you could still buy them that small. And a lot of people have those for their compact purpose. So it doesn't take up a lot of room.
So he, Bree shows up with the wash. He offers to take care of it for her. He takes it inside. She stays outside with Jem and he goes inside, accidentally knocks some of the drawing down. As he's trying to put it back, he finds her drawings, a bonnet. And he misses Jem's first steps, which was, it was very, very cute wave. It was very sweet. Now, I wonder, Summer, because I know she had sketches as well. That's not a change. Do you think, and it's not even necessarily.
Dream journal?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think there's going to be
more. You
think
they're going to do her dream journal?
They said something about dream journal. Oh, I thought it was mentioned on Twitter or someplace in an interview. I want to know, what do you think Roger was really concerned about with the pictures of Bonnet? Was it that she's clearly still affected by it and not talking about it? Or is it pictures that look just like Stephen Bonnet and then also look like Jemmy?
That's funny.
So I'm like, I don't know. But definitely, I don't think that drawing and keeping these pictures is doing good things for her. I think if she was drawing and then getting rid of them, but drawing them and keeping them is literally just keeping this memory fresh. But I've not been that a victim of that type of brutality. So I can't really speak on behalf of what makes anyone better. It would just, as an outsider, it would seem to me that harboring them and keeping them would just keep it fresh. But that's
my best guess, is that he's not necessarily surprised that she did that. But I think it's probably that she's keeping it from him because he wants to help her. And yeah, there may not be anything he can do. But I think the fact that that she does it like multiple times and hasn't mentioned it to him, I think he's even more worried. He loves her. He cares for her. He wants to be able to help. And outwardly, she's not expressing that she needs help or that he can't do anything. And maybe he can't, right? This is how she's, at least at this moment, this is how she's able to not express herself, but this is how she's handling it at the moment.
So if they knew that Jem could hear the stones, the quickest and safest way to get her safe is to take her back to the future. I'm just going to put it that way. Guess who doesn't exist in the future? Stephen Bonnet.
And the boxing hooters.
Oh,
now,
my God.
This was definitely not expected. Now, okay, part of this is in the book. I don't remember the boxing hooters, but I do remember that at the end when Bonnet destroys the other dude's eyes. That's legit from the books completely. I love Forbes' line, quote, "My money's on the stocky damsel." Stocky. I love it. Bonnet is accused of cheating and being in cahoots with the winning hooter. Now, when they're swordsing it up on that dirty ring and the camera goes around and it gets Bonnet from behind, our pirate is wearing like gold lamé poofy pants.
I called them Bonnet's bunchy britches.
Oh, Lord.
Because
they make his booty look good. I mean, they're round.
They made his booty pop for sure. But they. I don't think his butt really does that. That's the whole thing. Like they had a butt of their own. And
oh, man.
What was the other thing? Also, go back and watch the sword fighting scene and just take the swords, if you can, with your brain, try to take the swords out. And it just looks like the most like ridiculous dance battle that you've ever seen.
Summer.
Just imagine no swords. And it's like a fun dance battle.
When asked, why not just kill the man that you just mutilated? He says, I considered it. And there's more lines in there, too. But I'm a father now.
In my bunchy britches.
Definitely. Oh, and I didn't say this earlier, but there's more than the theme more to the theme than this, but the thing that you can hear and you'll know it's at least part of Bonnet's theme right away is dun da 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 da. You hear that when Roger sees his picture. I don't think we hear it in the beginning. I could be wrong when she's drawing. I could be wrong though. But we definitely hear it here when he's talking about I'm a feather now. Oh my. Like I said, definitely Bonnet's theme at the end. Also, Herman Husband Pirate is played by Paul Kennedy. I looked him up and he definitely does not look anything like Herman Husband.
No, it's all beard.
It's all beard. Oh,
but
Lord,
you know
it's
what's
beard
funny?
In bulk.
I went back and I immediately like Googled Herman Husband. And one of the first things in the Google search is a dude with a giant beard. So I was like, so literally Stop. They could have hired anyone and put
and a
gigantic
beard
on them. And they'd have been like, cool, it's Herman Husband.
I hope they keep Herman Husband's role in the, obviously the figure is there, but I hope they keep his like certain scenes in there. We'll see. Also, because of last week when I saw the people who we were not introduced to, but who had FaceTime and the characters were actually there, the bugs, namely, I am going to do that for each episode now because I find it fascinating. And one of the names that popped out this episode, I was like, what? What? Was Uta McGillivray, played by Anya Karmansky.
She had lines.
She did, actually. And you could tell she was a woman with the German accent, right? During that candle making scene, correct?
Yes.
And I wrote, in the candle making circle.
Mm-hmm. It's not a wool walking circle.
That's it, folks.
So next week, as we said, look forward to Brownsville and the Beardsleys because we're about to meet them.
More
gore. That's our monster of the week. And as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, please go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a special thanks to our sponsors, Brooklinen and Best Fiends. And we haven't forgotten about a final shout out to co-producer Laura D. And to find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit patreon.com/outlanderpod. And don't forget, there are still a few spots left on our Pod Abroad trip in 2021. You can find out more about that. Always send us an email. We'll always answer questions about that. hello@outlanderpod.com. But to be taken straight to the itinerary, etc., go to podabroad.com. And if that's not working out for you, the link, the direct link to the itinerary will be in our show notes. So thank you guys, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.